Hi, this is Laura, and a big hello to our podcast subscribers. Hi. And if you haven't officially hit the subscribe button yet, please do so at your favorite podcast app. You can also watch the show now on public television. Check your local listings for the day and time, or watch the premiere each week on the World Channel, Sundays at 11:30 a.m. Eastern. We're also live on YouTube. The show remains ad-free thanks to you, and especially to our Patreon partners. Feeling left out? Join them at patreon.com/the LF show and become one of our possibility-making partners for as little as $3 a month. You are the wind at our backs. We couldn't do this without you. Thanks. Now, on with this week's show. Hi, I'm Laura, and this is the Laura Flanders Show, a TV and radio program that shines a light on the solutions of tomorrow today. We report on the people and movements driving systemic change from the worlds of politics, arts, and entrepreneurship. Welcome. While the election results are still undecided, we'll hear from Mary Kay Henry, president of the Service Employees International, or SEIU, about how one of the nation's largest unions is addressing the ongoing impact of COVID-19, pandemic poverty, and the systemic inequalities that no single election can fix. We need a new normal, says Henry. How do we get there? That's this week on The Laura Flanders Show, the place where the people who say it can't be done take a backseat to the people who are doing it. Welcome. Speaking a few days before November 3rd, I began by asking Mary Kay Henry how her work and the work of labor advocates will respond in the context of a Biden presidency and in the context of a Trump one. Mary Kay, we feel in many ways sort of on the precipice of something as we're speaking. We've seen a year of the worst. We're talking about creating not just a return, but something new. What are your next steps in this moment? How do you think about elections in this context?
We think elections matter for making a demand on what we as working people and communities of all races have the right to expect in this nation. And so this election matters because of the depth of the crisis that we're facing that's unlike any time in our generation, certainly, but I think we will probably conclude the history of our world. And so who leads our nation and how our government behaves matters. And so we don't think the election is the only thing. We think of it as a step in how we are going to achieve the just society that our members organize around and bargain and stay in the streets demanding every day of our lives.
And if we are looking at a Trump next term, where do you go from here, Mary Kay Henry?
Well, we are going to make progress in the states where we can unite our political power with our organizing demands and show how we can rewrite the rules. In places like California, where we're backing gig workers who are trying to rewrite the rules with that emerging part of the economy, we're going to try and make progress for fast food workers in Chicago, which is the hometown of the multinational corporation that has the ability to set standards, not just for the million people they employ, but for the 4 million people in that sector. So we will continue to press for bold transformative change in cities and states. And then we will mount an even fiercer resistance to the policies of the Trump administration that have sharpened our muscle across movement to say that we are not going to stand for further attacks on immigrants, on the Black community, on the climate, that we're going to stand in solidarity to demand better from this administration.
People have high expectations. I imagine yours are fairly realistic when it comes to a Joe Biden administration, because you lived through the Obama-Biden administration and stayed in the streets, in fact, saw some of your most vibrant organizing in those years.
Yeah, I have to tell you again, we refuse to return to thinking about the past as a measure for what we should expect in the present. And because the depth of the crisis is so beyond anything anybody's ever experienced, and we've just seen huge shifts happen in the last 8 months, $3 trillion was released from the federal government in a six-month period and went mostly to corporations and the wealthy. We have to be as bold and transformative in how we tackle the crisis for everybody in this nation. And so we intend to stay in the streets, to double down on organizing of non-union workers, of uniting our fights across movement, and expecting federal and state government to do bold transformational change in all aspects of our lives. And our unique contribution is going to be to make home care jobs the foundation of the next most inclusive, most racially diverse middle class that this nation has ever seen. In the 30s, the way the National Labor Relations Act, the Fair Labor Standards Act, Social Security all got enacted was through a racist compromise that was made with white Southern legislators who didn't want workers who did home care work, domestic work at the time, farm work, child care work to be covered. And so those jobs got written out, and it's why the NAACP regarded all of those New Deal initiatives as Swiss cheese, because there were so many big holes in it that Black workers fell out of, and brown workers in the West, that it didn't really lift everyone. And that's what I think this moment calls for, especially with the racial reckoning that this nation has to do in every aspect of Black America's life. I think as the labor movement, we have an obligation to insist that Black and brown workers be treated with equal dignity and respect. And this is the time to push that through and make it happen on scale, because too many Black and brown families are grieving the loss of loved ones, either through state violence or through a pandemic where our government had a callous disregard for those communities.
Now, your members include janitors and food service workers and airport workers and home care workers. They've had a tough year. It's hard to think of any group that has had a tougher year. Describe what they've been through.
Well, the onset of the pandemic and the complete and utter failure of our federal government to think about how to protect every essential worker on the front lines was the first hit on all of our members. And then the second hit was the economic collapse that's resulted in 30% of our airport members had lost their jobs, many more with hours reduced. Our home care workers started experiencing reduction in hours as their consumers decided not to have people coming in and out of their homes to care for elders. Our registered nurses and physicians and technical workers that were on the front lines of the pandemic didn't have enough personal protective equipment. We still have that problem 8 months into it. So, and then, as you know, in May, there was an escalation of the racial reckoning in this country, and our members across race have been incredibly proud to stand with the movement for Black Lives, because it's who we are as a union, and we think it's essential to the future of workers' power that we uproot racism as well. And then our members along the West Coast had family members die in the fires because poor and working class people don't have the resources to evacuate. And many were contending with elders. And the fight around climate justice and the crisis in the climate is another thing that essential workers all across our union and across the country have been absorbing. And so I think you're right, Laura, that I hear our members say that they're holding grief in the same quantity as they are holding a righteous indignation that we are not going to return to normal. Normal never worked for us. We refuse to go back. We're going to use this crisis to create the world that we've always dreamed of for our children.
So how are we going to do that? And first, we have to be informed. We have to learn lessons. Are there any periods that you compare to this one that you learn lessons from?
Well, I think we draw from the early 1930s when there was militant action on behalf of working people across race that made transformative change in the condition of working people and labor. The Flint sit-down strikers created a standard of auto work in this country that eliminated poverty wages and started to build a middle class. And we take that lesson and apply it to home care and child care workers in this period because we want to use those four crises that I just outlined to fuel a bold change where home care and child care workers get to be paid a living wage, have secure benefits, do one job for elders, people with disability, or children, and are able to lead a decent life. And so those are the one touchstone. I think another touchstone that I've heard our members talk about is we had the capacity as a nation after World War II to help Europe rebuild. We need to draw on that same capacity and scale to think about how to build a new America that includes everybody, undocumented immigrants, Black Americans, Asian Pacific Islanders, Native Americans, and white working poor people that have always been excluded. And this is the moment in our minds to include everyone.
You make an interesting point, though, when you refer to the sit-down strikes of the auto industry, and recessions historically have typically hit manufacturing industry most. That's our vision, the Hooverville guys who worked on the shop floor. Your workers are dispersed. They work in people's homes as well as in the other places we've mentioned. How do you update the sit-down strike of the 30s to this moment and to the workers you represent?
Well, we've been doing it, we think, through the Fight for 15 for the past 8 years when fast food workers have galvanized strikes. Most recently, on July 20th, we did a strike for Black Lives that was cross-movement with the Movement for Black Lives, Dreamers, other parts of the labor movement joined in and either actually struck that day or they did a solidarity action of kneeling for 8 minutes and 46 seconds as a way to say that we're going to stand together for each other.
So recalling Colin Kaepernick taking the knee and recalling how long the police officer had his knee on the neck of George Floyd.
Yes, exactly. And so those are the ways in which we have to update. We have to be intersectional in our fight for economic and racial justice combined with immigrant justice and climate justice because it's who working people are in this nation and will increasingly become. And our nation is a service and care economy where underpaid workers are experiencing unemployment in the double digits, I think at 18%, and higher paid workers are experiencing 1% unemployment. So when we hear the unemployment numbers, it doesn't really tell the story of the double impact that's happening in Black, Brown communities and on women across race.
This is the Laura Flanders Show. I'm Laura. My guest is Mary Kay Henry, president of the SEIU, one of the nation's largest unions. In addition to listening to this radio show and podcast, do you know you can also watch? Our post-election roundtable premieres November 8th on public television stations all across the country. This week, I'm joined by Maurice Mitchell, National Director of the Working Families Party and one of the leading organizers in the movement for Black Lives, Stacey Mitchell, co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and Scott Nakagawa, longtime senior partner at Change Lab. Subscribe to our newsletter at lauraflanders.org and never miss out on a thing. In addition, check out my discussion on the future of climate justice work with Jane Fonda of Fire Drill Fridays. You can find all that and my latest F word, where I remember those lost to the pandemic, at our website. That's lauraflanders.org. Next, Mary Kay and I discuss how service workers in other countries who've similarly gone through COVID and a recession are faring in comparison to us here in the U.S. Are they doing better? And if so, why? First, though, here's Born Ready by Tefpo and Rebel Diaz, featuring The Reminders from their Multiply Volume 2 EP, courtesy of Rebel Diaz.
Slipknot to my stomach all day though. SoundCloud draped around my crown like a halo. What can I say though? Anything to bring peace. My manic never sleeps. Can't afford to have a shrink on the payroll. So I let it all go. Turn the lights down low. Pull myself between the lines. Step up to the mic and I let it all happen. This ain't rapping. This is meditation. Mantras, tantrums. This is elevation. My soul needs space that my body can't hold. So it bursts through the gates. Translates everything to a page where the words rearrange and I let it all go.
Break 'em out tomorrow. I was born ready. World at my disposal. No, I'm gon' get it. My bags are always packed. 'Cause I was born ready. We never heard of fear. 'Cause we were born ready. Born ready, born ready. Born ready. Born ready, born ready, born ready, born ready. Born ready. Born ready, born ready, born ready, born ready. Born ready.
Are other countries handling this differently? You talked about what the U.S. helped to do with the Marshall Plan in Western Europe. Are there countries that have similarly gone through COVID, similarly gone through the kind of recession we're going through, but workers comparable to your members are faring better, and why?
Yes, you know, it was one of the first things we did, Laura, was we talked to trade union movements around the world in March and April, because we were really interested, given what was going on in Italy. At the time, what was the healthcare workers union in Italy doing? Or what were the Australians doing? Or how did Scandinavia respond? Or South Africa, where we have the most ties. Japanese workers are the other ones that we've done ongoing work with. And it's night and day. There's a federally coordinated response. Employers and working people through the trade union movement are at a tripartite table dealing with PPE, dealing with keeping people on payroll and at reduced amounts. So fast food workers in Germany are at 80% of income, but were staying at home safely. In the UK, they were at 90% of income, but staying home safely. And there wasn't this scramble for personal protective equipment in hospitals or across the front lines. Healthcare, as you know, in many of these countries has long been settled, so that wasn't the crisis that is still unfolding in our nation. And for God's sake, 2 weeks of paid sick leave that is not a standard for 64 million service and care workers in the U.S. is a standard in other countries around the world. So we were way behind the starting gate just in terms of wages and benefits for workers before the pandemic hit, and then the coordinated response of those governments together with employers and the workers made things much saner for workers in other parts of the world.
You've also joined with other labor union leaders in other parts of the world to bring a lawsuit not so long ago at the UN Labor Agency. Tell us about that and what you charge this administration with doing, because maybe that's a first step to actually bring some charges.
Yeah. As we were working in the at the state level to try and secure the protections that workers needed and the economic security, we started thinking about how could we hold the federal government accountable, given how reckless and irresponsible the current president and the entire administration has been. And so we looked to the United Nations Charter and we looked to the International Labor Organization's basic standards for workers and have filed a complaint with the International Labor Organization saying that we believe the U.S. is violating the labor standards that we've signed on to as a nation. And it was a way for us to be able to tell the story of American workers in an international forum and get action and attention to it. Because multinational corporations in our country could still be making different decisions than they're making, even without a federal government response. And instead, I would argue the multinationals are taking advantage of the federal government's callous disregard for working people. McDonald's was in Congress arguing at the CARES Act not to provide 2 weeks of paid sick leave. They were arguing against the enhanced unemployment and then said to their stores, go ahead and provide 2 weeks of paid leave if you can, but they wouldn't change their economic model to allow franchise owners to do that. They gave dog diapers out to workers in Oakland who then struck for 46 days because there was no serious securing of any personal protective equipment. So there's been indignity after indignity thrown at the lowest wage workers in the economy throughout the crisis.
I've got just a couple of other areas of questions, but one of them has to do with this comparison between now and the 1930s. One thing you've just mentioned is international action and a sense of internationalism. And some of those ILO type agencies perhaps didn't exist in the 1930s. The UN came out of that era. There was a sense of international labor solidarity at that time. How would you compare then and now? And is that something that you look to as something we need to sort of ramp up in this period?
Yes. You know, our union has had very successful solidarity efforts that has resulted in workers' power being expanded in the U.S. So we've organized 50,000 security officers, primarily Black men, thanks to the solidarity of the Scandinavian unions, where Securitas, who's one of the world's largest employers, is headquartered. And they use their power to force Securitas to a table so that we could organize the union with the security officers who in the US were demanding it. We've done it in airports. Airport workers' unions in other parts of Europe, Australia, South Africa are incredibly strong, and they used their power with the airlines to force contractors in the US to behave differently. And we've organized 40,000 airport workers in the last 4 years. We have a plan, even in this economic disaster. Workers want the protection of a union because they're being treated so badly in our nation's airports. And so that's another area of solidarity. And the most emergent area is in fast food. We've had fast food leaders. Terrence Wise from Kansas City testified to the Brazilian Labor Commission. Adriana Alvarez testified at the European Commission to talk about how tax avoidance was happening globally and hurting all workers, and what they were doing that undermined workers being able to get out of poverty wage jobs and into jobs that they could support their families on here in the US.
So internationalism is one approach. What about inside the US? And again, I'm really asking you to compare the muscle and ability to flex that muscle that existed in the 1930s and that propelled some of the kinds of changes that brought about the New Deal. Can you compare the sort of status quo then with the situation now? And what do you think we need today to fit this moment?
I think we need to draw on the militancy and direct action that defined the labor movement in the 30s, where there was a commitment to taking to the streets and shining a light on the grossest inequality of that time. And we are now in an age where the inequality gap is even worse than in the 30s. And the racial and gender dimensions of that inequality have been exacerbated because of the systematic attack on voting rights and on workers' rights and all the other things that were won by the 30s and 60s in this country and have been eroded. And so I think we need to combine militant action with mobilization across sector, where we unite with the racial justice movement, the immigrant movement, the women's movement, the LGBTQ, the climate movement, to create a united force for change. And then the third thing we need to do is make a decision as a labor movement that we are going to rewrite the rules that have been rigged against workers being able to join together and have the power to bargain a better life. So in fast food, we can't organize a national union in fast food because the law bars it. So we've been organizing this movement around the law because we're bound and determined to rewrite the law by forcing McDonald's, Wendy's, and Burger King to a national table and making a private agreement with us that we could then codify in law if we have to. And that's what auto workers did. There was no law that protected GM, Ford, and Chrysler workers from making common cause with each other. Their militancy forced the companies to a joint table, and the Democratic governor in Michigan decided not to call out the National Guard to suppress the strike. It has been done in other states. And so it does also require us to open a front in using our political strength to get elected officials to stand with workers as they challenge corporate power.
Mary Kay Henry of the SEIU, I have just one last area to ask you about, and that is the place that you began in this interview, where you talked about this moment being an opportunity where kind of everything is up for grabs and we really could make anew our relationship with one another, the planet, work. Can you see that from here? Can you see that sort of new day from here? And how do we get from here to there?
Well, I get from here to there by following the leadership of the members that we have in the street and the organizing leaders. Like Demetrica Shipp is a home care leader in Wisconsin. She had a union before Scott Walker. He took it away. She stayed involved in our union through the Fight for 15 and a union movement. And now she's on fire, turning out her family, friends, and community to vote in North Milwaukee because she's not going to let any Black voter who's too discouraged or too disillusioned to not understand the power of their vote and voice. And then she's taking that and saying, we're going to make the caregiving economy that Biden has introduced become a reality by creating 3 million jobs that have at least a $15 minimum wage and the right to join a union across the home care sector in this country. And so she's the kind of leader that gives me hope. And I can go through each part of our union and share fast food leaders who have understood the power of their leadership in the union as they've fought to raise wages and then transfer that power to other parts of their lives, like Tina Watson, who's in South Carolina. She's a mother of a 7-year-old. She sent him across the street to help a neighbor who was being evicted, and her 7-year-old son was harassed by a policeman that was waiting outside the door for the family to empty their apartment. And the policeman lifted his shirt and patted him down and then found a toy gun in his pocket. And Tina was watching this through her kitchen window, went marching over to the officer, asked for his name and badge number, said he had no right to treat her son like that. Her son was simply trying to help a neighbor. And she didn't stop there. She called the supervisor, said she wanted to file a report. And she said, I would have never had the guts to take all those steps unless I'd been involved in fighting for the union. Because I now understand that my leadership matters, my voice matters, my vote matters, and I got to use it in every aspect of my life. And so that's the kind of thing that gives me hope, because our movements across labor, climate, immigrant, you name it, allow people to realize the full potential of their leadership. And it gets unleashed in moments like this to drive bold transformational change at every level of society.
It doesn't sound like going back to normal is what you're aiming for.
No. No, our members refuse. It didn't work for us. We're going to create the next new normal that includes everybody. Nobody's going to get left out.
That was Mary Kay Henry, president of the Service Employees International Union, or SEIU. For more information on this episode, including the episode notes, our research, and some of the related shows we have in our archive, and to hear my interview with Jane Fonda, go to patreon.com/theLF Show. That's patreon.com/theLF Show. While COVID-19 has laid bare the flaws that have long existed at the foundation of our economic system, we at The Laura Flanders Show are steadfast in our determination to report on potential solutions. With or without an election outcome, we still can pull together. You are the wind at our backs as we move forward. We couldn't do this programming without you. So please become a Patreon partner today by becoming a subscriber. It's super easy, only takes a couple of minutes, and we rely on you. That's patreon.com/theLF Show. And thanks. Major funding for this program is provided by the Novo, Tomcat, Cloud Mountain, Fonda, Park, Shift Tides, and the Poss Family Foundation, as well as listeners like you. Thanks for listening, thanks for contributing, thanks for your ideas. Stay kind, stay curious. Till the next time, I'm Laura.